Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show, where ordinary heroes tell extraordinary stories during unique and never been heard before conversations with your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Hillary's unique listening and way of asking questions results in conversations that aren't usually talked about, so you can create the life that you really want but are afraid you can't really have. We are demonstrating the greatness in the human spirit in creating a world where we all reclaim our birthright of joy, happiness, purpose, and passion. Now, here's your host, Hillary Arno Burns. Welcome to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And today we have a very special guest. Her name is, you know what? I'm going to bring her in and then introduce her so you can see her. Her name is Sally McQuillan. Let's see. Should I read these letters? LCSWCADC. So Sally is a psychotherapist in private practice, specializing in addiction, grief, and trauma recovery. An avid reader with a double major in writing and dance criticism in college, she began working in public relations and marketing prior to obtaining her master's degree in social work. She and her husband live on the North Shore of Chicago, where they raised their three children. Reaching for Beautiful is Sally's first book. Thank you, Sally, for being here. And I have to show them your book.
There it is. Reaching for Beautiful.
Reaching for Beautiful, a memoir of loving and losing a wild child. So I just have to say, from reading the book, it's beautifully written, really beautifully written. And I'll say you, Sally, you know, you take us through losing your child, the grief, but also it's woven into his life. And so, you know, we really get to know him. We get to know, you know, what it was like raising him and, you know, how it was for you. And it was just a beautifully, beautifully written book. So thank you for that. But why don't you tell the audience what you mean by a wild child?
Oh, it would be my pleasure to give you some little stories about my Christopher. I wrote this book. Initially, I was writing it to him. I started as if I was texting him almost, and it became a daily journal about 21 days after he died at the age of 21. And I wanted it to be a means of connecting with him because I didn't really know where he'd gone. And he had me, I had the biggest crush on my firstborn boy. Mm. I was enamored with him. He, from the very beginning, challenged me to no end. He had that sort of excruciating, exhilarating arrival into the world. I remember people saying, well, you won't remember how painful it is to give birth. And I still haven't forgotten how painful it was to give birth.
Yeah. Why was it so excruciating?
I think it was interesting in that, this is a funny story. They thought, the doctor said, you know what, you might be losing amniotic fluid. And I was one of these sort of naive, you know, first parents who said, well, I really want this to happen naturally. And let's, you know, I don't even want an epidural, I thought, and all of that. And so fast forward, she says, tell you what, we'll let it go a little bit longer. But if you haven't had any contractions by 5 o'clock, we're going to need to induce you. Well,
so had your water broken? Is that why you were losing?
It hadn't broken. They just wanted to, this was in the beginning of the days where they started to schedule, you know, we're going to induce you and do it a little bit earlier than he's expected, just because we don't want you to continue to lose this this amniotic fluid or whatever. So then we get this phone call at 5 the next morning, and both my husband and I, Joey and I, were thinking we had 5 until that evening. But no, they said, where are you? Why aren't you here? They'd meant 5 in the morning. And it was as if my water had broken,
right. Raced
off to the hospital to be, you know, quickly induced, which sort of intensified my labor. And it happened in a sort of fast and furious way, which was very consistent with who Christopher ended up being once he arrived. Fast and furious, not furious, but just on the go, it moving at a pace where he was all in, always in motion. Ooh. And so we had emergency room visits, you know, from the very beginning. When his sister was born, I took my eyes off of him for a second, and he fell, you know, after having climbed on the outside of the banister and needed stitches. And these were the kinds of, there were just constant sort of antics and trying to keep up with him. He had me at the edge of my seat. And we didn't know until he turned 10 that he had attention deficit, which was the point at which my husband also realized that he had it. And no wonder, he just didn't stop. He was, and he was very sweet, sensitive, and gravitated to people. Mm-hmm. So he was a charmer from the start. And I wasn't the only one who was charmed. Yes. And he even, I don't know how much longer thereafter, other incidents where he fell down, and I started to develop an expertise every time we went to the emergency room as to whether or not it would require stitches or this or that, or if we even had to go. And when he was 4, lightning ended up striking a tree next to our house, not too far from his bed. And it was the first sort of blush of, oh, I could lose something so precious to me. You know? And it's interesting, because then when I did lose him, it felt like a lightning strike. It felt like it cut so deeply through me. And so I wanted to write Reaching for Beautiful to capture the inside of what it feels like to lose a child. But I also really wanted to share his life story and what it was like to raise this incredible wild Mustang, and what I learned throughout, what kinds of lessons Christopher taught me in life and in his death, and now in spirit.
Now, were your other kids not like that? Like, was he definitely different than I know you said your youngest was a little bit, but
I would say it was really funny. Caroline, my daughter, who's 2 years younger, and then William is actually 6 years younger than Christopher would be. He too, it's so interesting. They all have variations on this theme. Mm-hmm. Caroline is relatively, she actually showed me indications that a child could maybe sit still, you know, so that I appreciated. I went on to become a preschool teacher, and I remember how baffled I was when the little ones would just sit in your lap for long stretches and let you read to them, because that wasn't, Christopher in particular was slipping through my fingers. And then by the time that Caroline came, I was trying to sort of protect her from him, because he wasn't thrilled that she'd gotten here.
Oh,
and then by the time William came along, Christopher was definitely off and running, and he tended to be more overstimulating, and Christopher would get overstimulated, and there'd be friction, and you know, I'd try to sort of protect the two of them from his wilder outbursts. So, yes, they each have it, but they present in different ways. And William said to me at some point, you know, I'd go to, at least I felt like I was, you know, I'd had to advocate for Christopher in school. And at that time, way back in the 90s, people knew what attention deficit was, but they didn't really know. And they weren't, you know, it's very unlike today where probably, you know, half of the little boys anyway are diagnosed with some sort of neurodivergence, yeah. You know, and then they're given all sorts of resources. And I kind of had to go after those. And then as I was learning, educate the teachers along the way about what he needed. And Christopher, being ever socially conscious, hated the fact that he learned differently, that he, you know, struggled in school, and had to be pulled out to sort of, you know, what you would have traditionally thought of as some special education.
One question with the wildness and the sitting on the lap with the preschoolers.
Yes.
Is it a girl boy thing or no? Like, was it always the girls that could sit still and not the boys? Like,
it is interesting to me, the more I've learned about it, it does very much present differently in girls. Caroline was better able to sit still, for example, but that's just one of the traits, you know, difficulty focusing and being in motion are pretty common traits, and they're more easily identifiable in boys, I think. And William, when it came to the point in school where I said to his teachers, you know, do you think he has this too? They were reluctant, as they had been even with Christopher, to provide a diagnosis. And I should have known better, because by the time William was a freshman in high school, he said, "Mom, I definitely have this. So do whatever it takes to help me here. You can't continue to be in denial about this." And because his had looked, you know, not so severe as maybe his dad's or his brother's, I'd kind of thought, oh, maybe he's fine. I'm also pretty high energy, so it shouldn't have come as a surprise to us. But it was this thing throughout the course of my parenting that came up for me, where I was really working to understand who I had, who these children of mine were. And with Chris in particular, because he was defiant, because you couldn't ask him to do something and have him do it, I'd never seen anything like it, not having realized that that's probably exactly how my husband had been, the 10th of 10 children. So imagine.
But was your husband still that way? Or as you get older, do you slow down?
He's developed all sorts of ways to manage and make the most of his attention deficit. And it's really mostly an asset in that he can multitask, and that his motor runs quickly, and he accomplishes so much. Obviously, I'm attracted to this energy, and yet it was challenging to me.
Yeah. Wow. All right. Sorry, I interrupted you. I forget where you were going.
Well, yes,
the teachers learned differently. Somewhere along that line,
I think this thing about getting to know who a child is, being challenged. I remember reading books, you know, your demanding child, your persistent child, your relentless child, and then not even having had the terminology, sort of even having my mother say, "Do you think he might be, you know, hyperactive and sort of never even having anything to any frame of reference. So he was just who he was. And over time, but
was he fearless? It sounds like he was fearless if he kept getting hurt, right?
That is one thing that my three children absolutely shared, was a complete fearlessness. Yeah. So we would go to, you know, my husband was a car dealer. He was working 12, 15 hours a day, and he was working on Saturday. So by the time we could all be together as a family, of course, I was ready to surrender the children to him. You know, like, okay, take them, they're yours. But if we were doing family activities, like if we went to an amusement park, guess where the four of them went? They went on the, you know, the highest death-defying ride. And I would be like, wait a minute, this is, no, I don't want my little ones doing this. You know, and they just, nope. One of the beauties of Christopher was that he was so fully in the moment. He was never, so that was, you know, it sort of looks like a recklessness, but there was something gorgeous about it because it was so pure. And so all in, and there wasn't ever a thought of consequences.
Wow.
So I then knew that he would be ripe for developing an addiction, because as I educated myself more about who he was and who I had, I also had to look at the fact that Joe and I, we met both when we were in recovery, both having made this incredibly big life change to get sober in our 20s. And again, then I was going to get my master's in social work. And I remember learning about nature and nurture, the chicken and the egg. And we didn't put as much emphasis on the power of genes back then. So I remember, and perhaps I was just naive and dismissing anything that had crossed, you know, my path, but I thought, okay, well, we'll, you know, we'll just nurture and love our children so much that we're going to prevent them from also developing this disease. And little did I know then, and recently just read statistics to suggest that if one of your parents has struggled with addiction, you are 2 to 4 times as likely to develop it yourself. If both of your parents do, you are up to 8 times more likely to develop addiction. So this has been a big part of my path, is this legacy of addiction, having been raised by an alcoholic father and then ending up being fortunate enough to stop drinking myself and change my life. And then
how old were you?
I was 25 when I stopped drinking. So
how did you know that you needed to stop? Like,
truth be told, I, you know, since we're getting real, and
yeah,
boy, do I love getting real. You know, one of the gifts of putting this book in the world is that I bring everything to bear. The only thing, what I learned as I had opportunities to, like, literally go to mediums and channel Christopher's spirit and ask him what he thought about my writing and sharing his life story, was that he wanted me to speak the truth in hopes that it would serve others. So reaching for beautiful in some ways is to help other grieving parents feel less alone, but it's also to help anyone grieving or to help anyone raising a child who struggles with addiction, because you're automatically then put in this position of high stakes. And I thought it was my job to try to prevent this from happening. And I couldn't.
And Yes.
Sorry.
I just started to go in different directions.
No, it's fine. So like with addiction, what's the difference between someone who likes to drink and someone who has an addiction? Yeah, has an addiction. Yes.
Like, so what, sort of coming back, that's right, to getting.
No, yeah.
That, yes, I was an 80s girl, and so particularly at that time, there were other substances that were on trend, and one of which is something that I started to abuse, and it scared me. And my father, during a brief period of his own sobriety, had said to me, you know what? You know, I am an alcoholic. We didn't even have the words for it before that. And so you might find that you end up feeling, and I said, well, I remember being on the phone with him. Well, how do you know, Dad, if you've crossed that line? And he said, you determine what you think is a reasonable amount to drink, and you never exceed that. Something about not having a stop button is a really good telltale. Ending up suffering really negative consequences and still continuing to abuse substances is another telltale. And I got lucky. The fact that I started to abuse a drug scared me. I didn't want to die. And that's what brought
it was me. When it was.
That was, yes, cocaine.
Okay.
That was what shifted the course of my life. It was really wild that in doing that, I got frightened enough to seek help because the timing was such that my dad had suggested this might also be a problem. I wasn't ready to let go of drinking then, but I'm really glad I did. I'm really glad I did. And it made such a difference.
So what about the cocaine scared you?
I remember one evening having done so much that I was almost convulsing physically. Yeah. And I thought maybe I might die. And I remember, you know, really at that point, having a foxhole prayer, sort of God, whom I never communicate with, save me, you know, kind of a thing. And then my life's path shifted. It wasn't until after my beautiful boy, Christopher, was born that I discovered that I'd known I was sensitive and felt everything deeply, but I didn't know that I was a sufferer of depression and anxiety. And of course, typically with addiction, probably 99% of us are actually self-medicating. We're trying to make ourselves feel better than we do. So it's not really that coincidental that this particular drug appealed to me, because it helped me to feel like my mood was more elevated, and it was typically not. Unfortunately, drugs, alcohol has consequences. It might initially serve to properly give you some of that respite, but usually it can backfire on you, particularly if you have this disease mechanism where you can't stop it at one, and you abuse more and more. And
so like, is it true that let's say you have a drink or you have whatever your substances, you won't stop?
Could you stop? And some people can, you know, now that I am a therapist in private practice, and I specialize in addiction, and I help people who are in recovery. I help even more people who are in relationships with people who are addicts, because this is sort of my life's path. And I very much hope that all of my personal experience every which way can help other people. And so similarly, writing this book is it's sort of designed with the same messaging about the impact of addiction or the impact of your loved one's addiction. And to have a child who then, you know, you're watching like a train going off its tracks and trying to determine what to do to help them was really kind of crazy. But some people can control it. Some people will binge, you know, whenever they, I remember that, you know, in my 20s where I didn't go out every night, I wasn't drinking first thing in the morning, but I was certainly, the second I started, I would continue to, and I'd have sort of objectives to, this is just going to be a fun night with a friend and we're just going to have a drink or two. It was never just a drink or two. Or if, you know, and so I knew all this. I knew this when I was looking at my son, even before he picked up a drink, that he was susceptible to falling into this, because he also was sensitive and had some anxiety, depression, and then recklessness. So all of those things are contributing factors to the development of addiction.
So if you, let's say you saw him having a drink, you knew it was going to keep going. It wasn't going to be one.
You know, the first time, the first time he, and he was, you know, he was just so wild. I couldn't necessarily pin him down. He was out with his friends. You know, typically in the year between eighth grade and freshman year, some of the kids, you know, can start to experiment. I think the first time that I knew that he'd experimented, one of his friends became unconscious. You know, they were just taking hard alcohol and guzzling it. And so there were consequences immediately, which then led to my attempts to intervene. And because there's also evidence to suggest that the longer you wait until you do experiment, the less likely you could develop addiction, which is interesting. It didn't work for my children, but it for some it does. You know, it could maybe offset other parts of the predisposition.
And do your other kids also have it?
My other kids also do. Yes.
So they can't have a drink. I mean, they can, but they'll.
They could, but there would be consequences. And, you know, my husband is Irish. There seems to be another sort of criteria for likelihood of developing it in the Irish culture and the Irish genes.
Oh, the Irish virus. That's what one of my friends.
Right.
Irish virus. Yeah.
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 So all of those things being true, this is part of not just my path, but the path of each of my children. And so Christopher did go on to, you know, we did intervene. We did everything in our power to support him getting clean and sober, because we knew that that would offer the promise of the best life that he could have. And it did, in that he had 3 years from age 16 to 19 where he was, you know, we had to send him away, but where he was clean and sober and developing the character and his best self, you know, because he, his best self was quite amazing, extremely open-hearted, very much loving anyone who did struggle and trying to lead them and sort of treat them with unconditional acceptance. So I try to embody that now, take more of who he was and is, and put it into the world. He then, after having that period, wanted to be normal like every other kid. and thought, okay, after having been clean and sober in a way, I want to go to college. I want to be with, you know, again, he'd often been just part of, you know, he was very camaraderie oriented. So it wasn't any surprise that he went off to college and immediately became a member of a fraternity and developed a brotherhood and just so many very solid relationships. And while he resumed drinking at that time, and that it indirectly cost him his life, I actually wouldn't have had it any other way, because it's what he wanted, and the people that he came to love and that loved him during that time are people who are still in our life today and that we get to love. Now we get to love their spouses, their partners, their children. So it's really remarkable. And yeah.
Wow. All right. Let us on that sigh. We will take our commercial break and then we'll be right back. So thank you for sharing him with us. And we'll be right back after a word from our sponsor.
Has social-emotional learning become just one more thing on your teachers' plates? Do teachers and students both find it boring and ineffective? Then bring Kikori to your school. Kikori transforms classrooms through experiential SEL activities that help students play, reflect, connect, and grow. Even better, students say it's more fun than recess. Schedule a no-obligation conversation at kikoriapp.com/bringkikori. K-I-K-O-R-I.
Hey, it's Hillary from Getting Real with Hillary. I want to share something really powerful with you today. Jerry Dale was deep in the music industry, providing girls, drug, and gambling opportunities, all while justifying it as making a living for his family. He questioned his path, but then God turned his life completely around. Now Jerry's on a mission to redeem and help others find their way back from the dark side. Jerry's book, Music, Porn, and Jesus, A Journey to Redemption, is his raw, real-life memoir of how God rescued him from the music industry, the porn world, and his own rebellion. It's not just a story. It's a testimony of grace, hope, and freedom. Visit IamJerryDale.com to get your copy and join a movement of redemption. If God can do it for Jerry, he can do it for you too. Hey, it's Hillary from the Getting Real with Hillary show. Life can be messy, raw, and real. And sometimes we're afraid to feel vulnerable. We're afraid to be that real self. Well, that's exactly what the Getting Real with Hillary show and Getting Real movement is all about. Being our true selves. Every week, I bring you stories of transformation, authenticity, and hope. People getting real with their struggles, their faith, and their breakthroughs. So don't miss a thing. Subscribe to my weekly newsletter today. You'll get stories, links to everything new, and how to create a life you love every week directly to your inbox. You can also find my books on Amazon. My courageous and riveting memoir, The Second Piece of French Toast, In Case You Feel Stuck in Your Life and Want to Get Inspired. How I Came Out About My No Sex Life and My Marriage, in my second book, Real Talk. That one will get you speaking up in ways you've been too afraid to do so, and really creating amazing freedom. And my third book, How to Stop Fixing Yourself and Start Having Fun, the name is called Your Bullshit is Your Blessing. Find links to everything and subscribe to my YouTube channel, Getting Real with Hillary, and you'll find the links in the header. So visit, and you can also visit gettingrealwithhillary.com, because the real you is worth it and wants to come out. back to the Getting Real with Hillary show. And thank you, as always, to our sponsor, KokoriApp.com. If you want to bring experiential social emotional learning to your schools, it really does create inclusion for all kids, even if they do have, you know, neurodiversity or whatever. It really creates communities. They bond and they start valuing each other, just like Christopher did. People are valued and included, and they connect with their heart instead of always being in fight or flight. So it's very useful. You can go to KokoriApp.com and check it out. And now we will bring back Sally McQuillan to talk more about her book, which is buried here, and now it's Reaching for Beautiful, a memoir of loving and losing a wild child. So thank you for that. So you were talking about how, you know, you're still in contact with Chris. Do you call him Chris or Christopher or both?
It varies. Most everyone else called him Chris and I call him Christopher.
Okay. Because yeah. I'm like, what should I think of? Yeah.
So Chris. Which is true for all of my, yeah, for my youngest as well, William, and everybody else calls him Will, you know, so it's just how it's gone.
Yeah.
But I look forward to reading each of your books and really appreciate what you shared about, yes, this process of getting real. And Christopher has taught me so many things. And part of letting some of the, you know, just the stuff of life slip away is in letting go of fear, because I was fear-filled. You know, we were talking about addiction and how it impacts people. And my father, as an alcoholic, could be volatile. And so I, as a little girl, assumed it had something to do with me when it had everything to do with his addiction. And he could get angry and it frightened me. And so I think I brought some of that trauma into my life as a parent. And then when I was recognizing that my son was also suffering from this addiction and fearful about that, it ended up kind of being something that I needed to work through, because I appreciated, even when, you know, during the course of time, especially when Chris was clean and sober, our relationship deepened and we were so close and connected. And then when he was off and running in his addiction, particularly knowing that his mother was sober, meant for, and I think this happens with most people who are doing something that they know their parents wish they weren't, you know, there's more distance. And so in the years of his life prior to his death, in those 2 years, I was cultivating the ability to let go of fear so that I wasn't chasing after him in the same way that I had. I wasn't always trying to track him down, keep him safe. I was letting him live his life, and it was a sort of age appropriate for me to do that since he was in college. And I was doing only one thing, and that was making a point of letting him know how loved he was and continues to be. And then just when I worked at getting better at that, he ended up dying. He and his and three boys on their holiday break in college went up to a friend's lake house in Wisconsin with a whole group of guys. And four of them decided to go out in the middle of the night in a canoe on a frozen lake, and none of them survived that. So when that happened in time through my grief, I needed to process so many things, and writing helped me do that. It not only helped me connect to him, but it helped me reconcile every decision that I'd made and think about, do I then want to, you know, should I have stayed fearful? And really kind of put me in this place where there were some really crystal clear choices. And I think Christopher's spirit sort of led me into the spiritual dimension of appreciating the importance of continuing to let go of fear, even though now I'd been traumatized by his death. I do think that grief over the loss of a child is always traumatic because it's out of time. Mm-hmm. And because we do take on the job of thinking that it is our task to keep our children alive. And the truth is that we all do die at one point or another. Christopher departed early at 21, but I got to be his mother and I continue to get to. And that's what helps me survive, is that if I'm really clear and conscious and mindful about doing what I was doing even before he died, which is just to love and cherish him, then healing happens.
Mm. So one of the things that I wanted to ask you, when he went down the mine shaft, that was when he was clean and sober then, right? Yes. But he still almost died then, right? And then later you found out that when he was walking from Machu Picchu, he also almost died, but he didn't, right? So what can you say about those?
Well, it's really interesting. So even during that period of time when he was clean and sober, he was 16. I think when he was 17, it was the time that he flipped a truck and walked out completely unscathed. I mean, completely flipped it. So that was really the first of those incidents. And then when he was 18, he was actually mentoring at the therapeutic boarding school that he had attended and leading these boys. They were on an adventure in Havasupai, and they were walking back to their campsite from having been near these falls. And there were a bunch of them, and they went into a cave, and there was an unmarked mine shaft, and my child didn't see well in the dark. And he later, I came to find that there was a boy ahead of him who was slipping, and he made sure that he was okay. And he ended up falling 50 feet down. And so this was just the nature of being Christopher's parents, was that there wasn't a period of time where our nervous systems could really rest. You know, we wanted them to rest. We wanted to be able to feel, you know, safe and
How
secure.
How'd they get him out?
Well,
he was hurt, right? He was hurt.
He was very hurt. He had shattered his whole right side, and he basically had, you know, was losing consciousness. And somehow
did they run back and get help, or how did
they ran back and they got help, and through a series of incredible miracles, a helicopter was able to come in and rescue him. And, you know, they pulled him up on the rope and they immediately airlifted him to a hospital. And we were called in the middle of the night and informed that we wouldn't know yet whether or not he was paralyzed until the point at which they directed him to the appropriate hospital or something. Well, my son, being who he was, you know, came home thereafter to recover, and he laughed about how, hey, mom, you know what? Just think, if it had been any later in the day when this happened, the helicopter wasn't even able to fly after, you know, a certain time. So, boy, we got lucky, didn't we, mom? You know, he just thought that was funny, and he kind of teased me about it. We didn't realize how traumatized we were or he had been by this experience. But when he was in the base of that cave, he dies 3 years later. And I'm looking at his computer where I see his limited amount of schoolwork in college. And one of his papers, turns out he was a really good writer. I think I'd known that. He'd always loved to read. He was always brighter than he himself knew. So witty, so funny. And he wrote this, it was sort of a narrative about his experience and having fallen. And I got to read it, and he shared about having seen a man down there. Well, there wasn't, it wasn't a man. There was, couldn't have been a man down there 50 feet below. It was, you know, some sort of an angel, giving us several years more time with our boy, and for which I'm eternally grateful. And it wasn't quite his time, but that sort of emphasizes some of what I've heard from various mediums, which is that there's free will, you know, and there's and then there are potentially certain exit points at which we may or may not have contracted to be here on Earth. And he was never meant to stay longer. And there is something about being forever 21. Suits him. It suits him. He was sort of beyond a Brad Pitt, you know, filled with light and spirit, and impacted so many people here, but I think is also impacting so many people from heaven, in terms of the love he continues to give. It just multiplies.
Wow. And then, so then just for my own curiosity, when he like a few, I don't know how soon it was after the mine shaft, he walked Machu Picchu, wherever that is.
Right.
And so you found out that he almost died there too, right?
Again, he didn't tell me. I didn't know. He'd said he was actually really, his recovery after falling down the mine shaft was motivated by the incentive to go on a trip to Machu Picchu. So he probably went a little earlier than he should have. You know, the doctors, you know, the PT signed off on it and all of that, but he literally had, you know, he was my $1 million man. I mean, he had a plate in his, you know, a rod in his foot and a plate in his arm, and, you know, his arm had been essentially broken in two. And so he was on this trip, and I knew that he'd gotten ill and that it hadn't been easy to do the hike way up, you know, to that high elevation. And I had heard from the owner of the ranch, where he'd attended his therapeutic boarding school and with whom he was on this trip for young men, that he insisted on leading the other boys. And it wasn't until later, when after he had died, we were in Arizona, and the owner of the therapeutic boarding school was giving a speech and raising money for their boarding school and talking about Christopher, that he shared that Chris had started to become feverish on the path and didn't think he was going to be able to make it, and told the rest of the group to go on to shelter without him. And so I didn't even know that had happened. And that
did they leave him there? Like, how did he then?
He did not leave him there. Okay. They got him and the rest of them to shelter. He'd gone into some sort of a shock. There was somebody who stayed with him, and fortunately, he'd been taken well enough care of that, you know, he'd just presented it as, oh, yeah, I kind of got a flu. And I mean, that was just kind of his way. But to have heard that he was basically saying, you know, go ahead, it's okay.
Yeah.
I'm good. That was his nature, and a beautiful nature. Of compassion. And so for anyone who is grieving the loss of their own child or any loved one, we get to embody their spirit, put it sort of, you know, Christopher is deeply embedded in mine. And he's taught me to have that kind of compassion that he had for others, and really lead with that, which is quite selfless.
Hmm. Well, we're almost at the end, believe it or not. It's crazy. What kind of guidance would you give people who might be grieving, who may have lost a child? You know, what's a message that you could leave with people?
I feel like this idea of compassion, not just for others, and I was suggesting it was selfless, but I think we have to start with compassion, you know, for ourselves. It's sort of like that quintessential putting our own oxygen mask on. Those of us who do try to help and serve other people in our lives, and that makes for most of us, and certainly it's true of mothers. We must first nurture ourselves, and in order to survive a loss like this one, which is devastating, it is just like letting our grief, because the grief is a testament to how much love there is. So letting it have its way with us, succumbing to it, surrendering to it, leaning into it, knowing it won't always be like this. And that our loved ones, Christopher, wants nothing more than for me to have a joyful, satisfying, fulfilling life where I feel him present in it. Mm. That's what I would share. And it takes time. All of it takes time. Such a process to move through it, but willing to lean into the process instead of fight it. We can't fight. We cannot fight. I can't fight. I couldn't fight that he was going to develop an addiction anymore, that I could fight that he passed young. All I can do is sort of embrace what is and, you know, find the light in it.
Mm. And did you stop blaming yourself?
I had to formally make amends to myself and process my guilt. Guilt is such a natural response to any grief, because we cannot control what happened. And we think that if we blame ourselves and torture ourselves that way, it makes it more controllable. And I had to forgive myself and come to peace.
Mm.
Yeah. Wow.
Thank you. And I just want to... I waited till the end because I didn't know if I could handle this, but a message from Christopher is that he's so proud of you.
He's just so proud and that he loves you so much. And he is sorry for any grief he caused you, but that he just loves you. He's so proud of you for taking on his message. And great job, Mom.
Thank you so much, Hillary, for sharing that. I sure hope he's proud.
He is. He's like, go on.
That sounds like him. There it is. There he is.
All right. Thank you, everyone. Thanks for being here, Sally.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thank you for watching this episode. I started getting real with Hillary when I discovered that I was a people-pleasing, pleasant phony and wanted to be more of my real self. We can grow together. If you will like the show, subscribe to my channel, and share this episode with your friends and family so that we can have a world that's more real.